Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton will be joining us later this hour with reactions to yesterday's January 6th hearing. But first, a crisis unfolding far from here. And it's been 5 months, 5 months since Russia invaded Ukraine. The war might have slipped out of our daily headlines, but it's still very much happening on the ground.
Tonight, the Russian military intensifying its relentless assault on civilians, striking an apartment building in Kharkiv. And in eastern Donetsk, Ukrainian officials say dozens are dead after a Russian missile hit this five-story apartment building over the weekend. Rescuers diligently combing through the rubble. Families desperate for word on their loved ones. This man is looking for his sister and nephew. He says he is waiting for a miracle.
NBC reporting on a Russian military strike earlier this week. Coverage shows that that strike hit an apartment complex, and Ukraine says dozens of civilians died. Hingham Emergency Room Dr. Frank Duggan knows this reality too well. He just got back from a five-week trip to Ukraine. It was his second journey to the country since the war began in February. Both times, he's been working to connect Ukraine doctors with American doctors using telehealth services for everything from checkups to surgeries. Frank Duggan joins us now to talk more about that work. Dr. Duggan, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, sorry about stumbling on your name there a little bit. I'm so glad to get to talk to you. We tried this once before when you were in country there, and your life was just too wild to be able to connect.
Yeah, we had some difficulty. I think I was traveling on a train between Kharkiv and Lviv at the time.
That's right. Now you've just gotten back. You got back from Ukraine last Thursday night. And I guess I want to ask you, that sound we just played at the top, is that accurate? Is that what it is like there now? Is that what you experienced?
Yeah, it's more than accurate. I think that, again, we've got a lot going on in our country right now. And I hope that we don't get distracted from, you know, the events that are occurring in Ukraine at the present time, because, I mean, it's really awful over there. The amount of civilian casualties is really quite impressive. Probably, you know, in my experience, and I was at the front as well as in Kharkiv, so areas that were, you know, fairly active, there's a lot of civilian injuries. I think that the Russians are indiscriminately bombing everything, you know, schools, places of living, residential areas, train stations, malls, stuff like that. I think that's very much an accurate portrayal of what's going on.
One of the things that struck me, Dr. Duggan, is you told our producer, Amanda Beland, basically that this was a time in your life where you were clearly able to see the distinction between good and evil. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things in life, you know, have gray boundaries. I don't think this is one of those cases. I think that clearly this is, from the Russian standpoint, I think, you know, kind of the embodiment of evil. I mean, when you're targeting, you know, civilians, children, trying to instill terror in a population and really, frankly, just decimating parts of the country. Some of these cities are just in rubble right now. It's going to take, you know, years for them to recover, you know, with, you know, the electricity gone, the water gone, you know, so many of the buildings, you know, being destroyed. So it's really a tragic situation over there.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about your story and your work, Dr. Duggan, is you are this kind of weaving together of tragedy and hope, responding to the tragedy, but creating hope. And I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing there. You spoke with our reporter, Gabriella Emanuel, about this work this spring. How are you working on the ground, and what's the goal?
So we've got kind of three focuses as an organization. My organization is called Healthcare Volunteers International. It's hcvi.org. And so basically, we're looking at kind of three areas of kind of dire need there. The first one is just capacity building and providing them medications, equipment, and supplies that they need. And, for example, I was up in Slovyansk, which is in the Donetsk province or oblast. And, the hospital I was working at for about 3 weeks, doing, you know, battlefield trauma surgery and stabilization, they had no running water at the hospital. They were out of suture, out of gauze, out of just basic necessities. And so, one of our goals is to be providing supplies. We have a bunch of partner organizations over here. We work with AmeriCares, MAP International to get equipment and supplies. And we brought about $1 million at this point, but we're looking to raise funds to go ahead and bring a shipping container because the needs are just, you know, just so elevated for, you know, basically trauma-related equipment, supplies,
and medication. Can you give us a couple of examples, things that you should be able to take for granted, but that you can't in terms of those supplies?
Oh, well, I mean, they were threading their own suture at the frontline hospital that I worked at because they had no standard suture. So they were sterilizing needles and threading their own suture. I haven't seen that in like 30 years as a doctor. I mean, no running water at a hospital. It's really quite impressive how adaptive the Ukrainian doctors are to their situation and managing to, you know, get good outcomes despite, you know, some real significant challenges that they're facing with regards to resources.
So we are talking to Frank Duggan, who's an emergency room doctor in Hingham, but just back from Ukraine after bringing supplies and working extensively on bringing telehealth support to Ukrainian doctors. So you've given us a little bit of an outline of the supply piece. Talk a little more about the telehealth piece that you're doing, Dr. Duggan.
So from a telehealth standpoint, we initiated this at the very end of my first trip, and now we're with five hospitals. Two are kind of frontline in Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. Two are in Kharkiv, and one is in Lviv, and two are specializing in pediatric patients. And our goal with this is to kind of do a bunch of things. One, to drive efficiency within the system by providing them an electronic record, but also to provide high-end video capabilities so that the physicians in remote areas can obtain consultations either with Ukraine doctors or with doctors, you know, in the United States with regards to patient management and care.
So excuse me for interrupting, but to kind of bring that home from listeners, as I understand it, what you're talking about is a GoPro on the front of somebody's head taping what's happening with a patient while somebody remote is watching and consulting. Is that about right?
Yeah, so we're using actually several peripherals. We're partnering with an organization called Vuzix, V-U-Z-I-X, and they make a smart glass. So we're using them. We also use an organization called Surgitel, who we're partnered with, which makes a special glasses that doctors wear called Loops that come out in an HD camera. So we've got a number of different ways of visualizing. The GoPro is one avenue we're pursuing as a lower cost. The smart glasses and the HD camera systems give us up to like 50 times magnification for the viewer on the other end. So a supervising doctor could be, you know, seeing a procedure anywhere in the world, basically live stream with a physician obtaining a consultation while they're doing the surgery.
So it is really incredible, this level of support. I'm going to play a little sound from here for you here. This is a doctor named Jonathan Berkowitz out of a Center for Emergency Medicine with Norwell Health in New York. That's from a podcast called 20 Minute Health Talk. They're trying to do some telehealth in Ukraine. And here's a reflection.
They're seeing things that they haven't seen before. And a lot of this is about phone a friend, where I always get the sense that the doctor in Ukraine feels isolated. They don't have another doctor to really talk about these complicated issues. And they're really relieved at the end of these consults.
What strikes me about that, Dr. Frank Duggan, is this idea that there's the medicine of it, but there's the holding up these practitioners who are working in, well, I mean, as you reflected to us, staggeringly difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I think, I think the telemedicine, to kind of reiterate what you just played, is a lot of these doctors in Ukraine are general medical doctors. So they finish training and they work in a remote area. They might be the only physician on site. And I think that they are seeing a lot of things that they don't typically see, particularly, you know, advanced trauma. And having an ability to consult in real time, I think, is a real valuable resource to them. And also allows us to kind of extend the capabilities of that physician, maybe keep patients on site rather than dangerous and insecure travel. Much of the country is not very safe to travel in right now. And so keeping patients in their homes or in their hometown obviously is a desirable type of thing. And also this provides a value in patients who are being discharged from the hospital, enabling them to get home sooner, but also not having to come back to the hospital again through, you know, potentially dangerous areas and still receive ongoing care in a similar way that we did during COVID.
So how does an emergency room doctor in Hingham wind up doing this work in Ukraine?
Well, I've been doing volunteer work for probably since med school. I started doing overseas work. I've probably got 25,000 international volunteer hours at the present time. So I've been around the world a lot. I formed my own organization in 2014. And we have a presence in six countries now, in Southeast Asia, Latin America, and Africa. Obviously COVID, you know, put a lot of things on hold for us. And then when Ukraine, you know, occurred, I went over there initially with intentions of just kind of, you know, personally providing my own services, but then quickly saw that there's a real potential here for a lot of other things, you know, involving digital health platforms as well as, you know, supply chain issues with the different organizations over there in hospitals and battalions. And then also providing direct patient care and, you know, showing them some different ways of approaching, you know, tactical combat casualty care and doing some training and, you know, looking at different ways of doing wound management.
Can you tell us an example, Dr. Duggan, of a connection you've made to support from here in the greater Boston area that's been meaningful to you in this work in Ukraine?
Yeah, so already we're doing some consultation with Mass General Brigham. I'll give an example. This is not war related, but I think that this is, I think, well, in some ways it is. We have a patient that we're dealing with cancer issues at the Lviv Pediatric Hospital. They're doing their first bone marrow transplant on this child. And we're going to be using telemedicine to follow the patient up, but we're having a consultation right now with, Tom Schiffler, the individual who set up the bone marrow transplant program at Mass General is now consulting with the oncologist doing their first bone marrow transplant for the Oblast of Lviv. And we think that, again, this is a great way of kind of expanding your capabilities. Although that's not a war-related thing, we do think that, you know, these are the types of things. Remember, all the other things are still going on. They're just more difficult to manage. And so I think that we're trying to look at this as something that provides an immediate benefit for the country, for the hospitals and the providers, as well as establishing something that's going to grow into a long-term service.
And that's a piece of it, too. We talked earlier about this integration of tragedy and hope, and you've got tens of thousands of hours of service. This technology, these approaches with telehealth that bring expertise from all over the world to a moment in a place that's acute— what's possible in the future as we get good at this?
Well, I think that this is not new technology. I think a lot of this is, you know, when we talk about telemedicine, telesurgery, teleradiology, a lot of it is just having some, you know, usually video form of communication tied in with some electronic record. The electronic record is a hard part because those are expensive. And so, I developed one on Google's ecosystem. Google really drives much of what we do as an organization, and we attribute a lot of our success to the capabilities that Google provides us as a nonprofit that's working with them. But we've been doing this since 2014, and one of the biggest advantages to it is, from a patient care standpoint, it allows capable physicians who, like your doctor mentioned, who may be seeing things that are maybe outside their zone of comfort. You know, they haven't done it very much, or they haven't done it recently, but would like some support or would like some guidance, but have good surgical skills that can be guided through a procedure. You don't have to take a pediatric neurosurgeon from, you know, Mass General and bring them to Cambodia or bring the patient over. Which dramatically decreases your cost. I mean, we're talking like $1 million difference in cost to, you know, let's say do a complex neurosurgical procedure with guidance on site, you know, via, you know, smart glasses or, you know, video resources, or bringing the patient over or sending the doctor, which is, again, much more complicated, you know, probably less good for the patient and their family. And so we've been doing that since 2014, very successfully. I think that one of the things in the organization that we look at is we look at ways that we can, you know, kind of leverage technology to create low cost, high impact solutions that are scalable. Yeah. And the scale is a big thing with us. Is something, and when we're looking at everything we're doing, we're looking at, you know, how do we go ahead and drive that to a much, much bigger number and a greater number of people to access.
So before we let you go, that gets to a question that's been niggling in the back of my mind. I mean, some of this sounds almost like science fiction, things that would have been unimaginable 10 years ago. But everyday challenges around just good enough internet and language barriers. How are you addressing those things, especially in crisis zones?
So internet, I think, for me, there's no better investment anywhere you go than in broadband. It's no matter what it costs, it's going to be cost effective when you go ahead and, you know, run the return on investment over a period of time and the number of users. So we, you know, for example, in Cambodia at the National Children's Hospital, we set up and ran their entire digital network for the hospital for them.
So you set it up to make sure it was there.
Yeah, I mean, they had no internet beforehand. You know, everything was paper-based, and you need the internet to go ahead and achieve these productivity gains and efficiency gains and quality gains that you know, the ability to exchange information easily and to collaborate, you know, enables. And so that's one of the things we focus on, actually, right when we get into a hospital, is looking at their internet services. And I mean, in all the locations I was at, that was something that we upgraded and that we're, you know, investing money in to have them have more reliable and higher speed internet connections throughout the hospital and throughout the areas that we work. So that's, I mean, something that's a very important component of this.
And just briefly, the language?
Language barrier? Again, Google Translate's amazing.
There you go.
I saw this morning a patient who I'm managing for a complex foot wound. This guy had had a sarcoma on his foot, and he had a partial resection, but the wound has been open and infected since last August. And we're now about 3 weeks into treatment, and the wound's healing extremely well. But he's sending me pictures on a daily basis and of his wound, and we're managing dressing changes with some special dressings called hydrocolloids, and then we're communicating back and forth using Google Translate pretty effectively.
That's wonderful.
And I've got probably, I mean, this last week I've seen people in Nicaragua. I speak Spanish fluently, so that's not an issue, but I've seen people in Cambodia, and I've seen a number of people in Ukraine in the last week who I'm doing patient follow-up on patients that did surgery, and we're communicating extremely effectively using Google Translate. It's really amazing that,
all right,
that's improving, yeah.
That is Dr. Frank Duggan, who is an emergency room doctor from Hingham, but serving around the world. Dr. Duggan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
There would be literally millions of civilizations out there.
Well, if there wasn't, it'd be an awful waste of space.
Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey in 1997's Contact, which was based on a Carl Sagan book about humans venturing beyond the stars. Well, this week, we cast our eyes to the heavens and saw stars we had only imagined until now. The James Webb Space Telescope, more than 20 years, $10 billion in the making, has sent back its first images of our cosmos, and we got to see them this week. In a sliver of the universe, we can now see with startling clarity the history of the Big Bang unfolding in thousands of swirling galaxies, gigantic nebulae, colorful star clusters. Wow. So to help us marvel at the stars, we are joined on the line by Kelly Beatty. He is the senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Tiziana. And boy, you sound just as breathless as the scientists who unveiled these images yesterday.
Well, did it rock your world?
Absolutely. You know, we'll get into this a little bit more, but this is something that astronomers around the world have been waiting for 30 years. It's 30 years since this concept was put forward. And the take home here is that we're looking at the universe not only with more detail, but in a slice of the spectrum, the infrared spectrum that we can't see with our eyes, that our telescopes can't see from the ground, that had been largely hidden. I mean, we've launched spacecraft that studied the universe at infrared wavelengths before, but they weren't this big, they weren't this powerful or capable.
And why wait 30 years for this? What makes it worth it?
Well, okay, so it's 30 years because that's it's been a pretty rocky road for the Webb Space Telescope, actually. First conceived in 1996, at that time it was supposed to launch in 2007. That's 15 years ago. And then it went through a lot of design changes. In 2005, it went through a major redesign, which ended up being what we have now. And it took until 2016 and $10 billion to complete the construction. It's a very complicated instrument that, you know, involving some technologies that really hadn't been invented when the telescope was first conceived. And because it is so expensive, you want to be very careful that you've done it right. I think a lot of listeners will remember that when the Hubble Space Telescope was launched in 1990, almost immediately at this point in its mission, scientists were about to unveil the first images, and they were aghast to realize that the telescope was not focusing all the light correctly. It was a huge problem, a huge scandal, and it took extra missions by the space shuttle to correct that. Now we have this Webb Space Telescope that is working even better than expected.
So let's pick that up. So I'm looking right now at our website, radioboston.org, where we've got one of the pictures, the Carina Nebula, right? Which looks like, I mean, it's magnificent. It looks like an orange foamy mountain range with a sky behind it more full of stars than I imagined was possible. What are we capturing? And describe it for us a little bit, Kelly, with these images.
That's a great description. So stars form in our galaxy and in every galaxy from clouds. Those clouds are rich in dust and hydrogen and other elements. And when the clouds compress, they literally, these stars form as precipitation, if you will, from the clouds. Our sun formed the same way. This Carina Nebula is in a southern galaxy that we can't see from here on Earth, and it's about 7,600 light years away. And what that means is that light has been traveling across space to us for that amount of time. We are seeing this as it existed before the pyramids were built. And so as these clouds condense and form stars, the stars light up. They're like flares that are hidden behind the cloud. We can't see them in visible light. Only with instrumentation that can see infrared, can see the heat, sense the heat from these newborn stars, can we really tell that they're all there. And that's what this first image is. The stars come to life, and they are intensely hot, and lots of ionizing radiation, ultraviolet and gamma rays and all kinds of stuff that would be harmful to us. And they vaporize the cloud around them. And so they create a pocket of clearing.
Where they're like breaking through.
Exactly. And so we're seeing at this water's edge, if you will, where the edge of the cloud is, these hot young stars have eroded away the cloud around them. We're seeing not only these young stars for the first time, but also we're seeing stars still embedded in the cloud as little glowing embers that are about to break free themselves. It's just a remarkable image showing how stars form in our universe. It's a kind of a universal phenomenon. Our sun formed the same way. And by the way, our sun probably didn't form by itself. It probably formed in a group very much like this.
So my chuckle for today will be thinking about the Webb Telescope and the phrase hot young stars, which was not quite where I thought we were going with it, but it's fun. And so here's the other thing that has been bending my brain, and I want to talk about it. So here's a little sound from President Biden, where clearly it bent his brain too. This is when he was speaking yesterday at the unveiling of the first photographs.
Light from the oldest galaxies, the oldest documented light in the history of the universe, from over 13 billion, let me say that again, 13 billion years ago. It's hard to even fathom.
It is hard to fathom, Kelly, and at one level I get it, but at another level, how is it possible that photos we took now are photographs of something that happened 13 billion years ago?
Yeah. So I mentioned, you know, I mentioned the Carina Nebula, 7,600 light years away. The Webb Telescope's biggest to-do list involved things that are relatively close by, like that nebula, like planets around other stars that we want to probe, and the very most distant things in the universe. Now, I think most people realize that the universe is expanding, but one consequence of that is that as light travels across the void, its wavelength gets stretched out almost like a spring. And so that
like
light
a slinky
might have,
that you're pulling from
like
one end to
slinky,
the other.
Like a slinky, a great concept, right? And when you pull the ends of a slinky, the little coils get farther apart. The wavelength stretches. And so light that might have left that very early galaxy as short, powerful radiation, like ultraviolet, has over time, over distance, become stretched out to the point that it's no longer even visible light. It's in the infrared. And so with the Webb Telescope, we'll be able to look farther to see this stretched out light from galaxies that, as the president said, have traveled for 13 billion years to reach us. And that image that was released yesterday, I know we're trying to describe it, so please go to the Radio Boston website or to skyandtelescope.org for a fuller picture and the actual pictures.
Yeah.
That picture that was released is actually possible because there is another cluster of galaxies between us and those distant ones. That nearer cluster is acting like a lens and focusing the light almost like a magnifying glass of the even more distant galaxies. So those very distant galaxies are kind of distorted and, you know, misshapen in the image, but they are every bit as telling as if they were crisp and like perfectly proportioned. And they're showing us that galaxies that long ago, just, you know, 300 million years after the Big Bang, were already alive and kicking. And what the Webb Telescope hopes to do is to see back even farther to the point
back
in the evolution of our universe, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the first stars formed.
Okay, so I have goosebumps from that because that's really back to the beginning. You know, Kelly, just briefly, there's this tension here, right? On the one hand, I feel like even though obviously I know nothing about this subject other than the wonder of it, there's so much we could learn if we really could go that close to back to the beginning. On the other hand, we live in a tough world and there's a lot to do. And it costs $10 billion to do this. So make the case that this was a good spend.
So, you know, everyone has something that gets their juices flowing. Obviously, for astronomers, you know, it's a astronomy, deep cosmic thoughts. For a lot of us, it's great art or performances or a garden that's blooming and, you know, fresh, warm tomatoes warmed by the sun. And so in this particular case, I think what this telescope is going to do is sort of raise our collective consciousness about what our place in this universe is. The Webb the Hubble Space Telescope gave us a taste of that. But we're really going to try to get back to the beginning here. And through that, get a better sense of how it is that we, on this small planet around an ordinary even dwarf star, our sun, in the middle of a large but not unusual spiral galaxy, the Milky Way, came to be. And I think that's the sort of mind-blowing, open-ended questions that the Webb Telescope will fuel with its discoveries. Obviously, we're going to learn a lot of technical information about how the universe works and, you know, how these things came together. But for everybody here listening, it's why do we exist? How did we come to exist? These are the bigger questions that will be addressed as well.
All right. So that's the whole universe. Let's come right back to here. Do we little Massachusetts in this whole universe have a presence in what's going on?
Oh, for sure. People don't realize this, but the Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, which is a joint organization between the Smithsonian and Harvard, has probably the largest concentration of PhD astronomers on the planet. It's like 300 working astronomers. Now, they're not traveling to distant places so that they can make these observations. The Webb Space Telescope is coordinated through a science center, if you will, outside of Baltimore. But when they want to use the Webb Telescope, and many of the astronomers here in our listening area, not just Harvard, but at Tufts and BU and other facilities, will be in a competition. We've heard these stories about, like, somebody is giving away a beautiful house in Maine overlooking the seacoast, and they'll give it to whoever writes the best essay for why they need this house. Well, that's what astronomers do when they line up to use the Webb Space Telescope or the Hubble Space Telescope or any major observatory. They make the case for why their observations matter. And in this particular case, they have to make a compelling argument that only the James Webb Space Telescope can answer the question that they're posing.
Amazing. Well, we will look forward to learning more about what they're learning. That's J. Kelly Beatty, senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. We wanted to talk to you about this. Thanks for joining us and sharing in the wonder.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
The January 6th hearings continue to reverberate around Massachusetts and the rest of the country. Yesterday, the committee vice chair, Representative Liz Cheney, closed the hearing with what could be a bombshell.
After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call, and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us. And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
So that's from yesterday, one of an ongoing number of hearings that aren't yet over, all focusing on January 6th. Joining us now on the line, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents the 6th District, which includes Amesbury, Newburyport, and Salem. Congressman, welcome back.
Good to be here, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, and how are you?
Good, thank you.
So listen, we are going to also talk about something that I know is very important to you, the mental health emergency hotline, and I'm looking forward to touching on that. But I think first, Congressman, January 6th is weighing so heavily on us, and you've been talking to WBUR and then to us about this literally since the day it happened. So we really wanted to get a chance to hear from you. Let's just start by your overall reactions to where we are in this hearings and what we're learning.
One of the most important things that we have to all keep in mind is that January 6th was not just a tragic piece of our history, but a preview of what could happen again in the near future if there's not accountability for those responsible. And what Liz Cheney just disclosed at this past hearing, that Donald Trump today is trying to tamper with witnesses, shows that he still believes he's above the law. And he and his followers could not only tamper with witnesses and try to illegally influence the remainder of these hearings, but very well try to overturn the next election, to take away the democracy from everybody listening, from all of us who cast a vote and expect it to be counted. That's why this is so important. It's not just about the past, it's about the future. And I think we see that again and again through the testimony.
You know, one of the things that we learned yesterday was just about the power of organizing and force. So one of the big areas of focus was a December 19th tweet from the former president, which read, quote, "Big protest in D.C. on January 6th. Be there, will be wild," end quote. And there was a lot of conversation about that being a call to action for the kinds of things that you worry could happen again. I'm going to play a little bit of a montage from the committee yesterday with white right-wing voices reacting to that tweet.
If you have enough people, you can push down any kind of a fence or a wall.
This could be Trump's last stand. And it's a time when he has specifically called on his supporters to arrive in D.C. That's something that may actually be the big push Trump supporters need to say, this is it. It's now or never.
You better understand something, son. You better understand something. This is going to be a red wedding going down January 6th.
How important is that tweet, do you think, Representative Moulton?
Look, I think it's important because it proves something that those of us who were there already knew, which is that Trump instigated this insurrection. There were a lot of people who wanted to follow his lead in claiming that the election was fraudulent and believing the big lie and actually take violence to overturn the results. But it was the president of the United States standing by the White House that morning who told the crowd to go to the Capitol, who knew that they would be violent and supported them wholeheartedly and freely expected them to break every norm of democracy, every law that we know in America that governs our elections, to just reinstall him as president. And if that's not an insurrection, I don't know what is. If supporting the calls to hang your own vice president is not an insurrection, I don't know what is. And that came from the president of the United States.
So, and one of the things that's been sort of lurking, of course, is the Patriot Front march here 2 weeks ago, and this increased idea that we heard about yesterday in the hearing, that it was also a catalyst moment that created a level of coordination and organization among groups that maybe hadn't existed before. This is a little sound from yesterday, Donnell Harvin, former Homeland Security Chief for D.C., about the different groups that came together then.
Some very, very violent individuals were organizing to come to D.C. And not only were they organizing to come to D.C., but they were these groups, these non-aligned groups were aligning. And so all the red flags went up.
It's that these non-aligned groups were aligning. Congressman, you've talked about, you just said at the beginning, the issue here isn't just what happened, it's what could happen again. Are we ready and responding in the ways that we need to a level of alignment that didn't exist before and that may have been, or the committee is arguing, was triggered by the former president of the United States?
No, we're not ready. We haven't been doing enough to respond. The January 6th committee is doing heroic work, but whether Congress will actually act on their findings, whether even the Justice Department will prosecute the president and his allies for what are clear violations of the Constitution and the law, that very much remains to be seen. And if there's one lesson we can take from history, from nations that have failed, is that if you don't put down insurrections, if you don't deal with lawbreakers, if you don't show the world that the principle that no one is above the law is true, then this will happen again. And that's why I truly fear for our democracy, not just because of what happened on January 6th, but because we're not doing enough to prevent it from happening in the future.
You know, I'm mindful of your service in the Marines. It's one of the reasons I was interested to hear your take today. I'm going to play a little sound from a committee member, Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin here, laying out information that the committee found from an encrypted group chat.
The Proud Boys launched an encrypted chat called the Ministry of Self-Defense. The committee obtained hundreds of these messages, which show strategic and tactical planning about January the 6th, including maps of Washington, D.C. that pinpoint the location of police.
You were there that day. You witnessed. You are a former Marine. Were there parts of the riot that day, the attempted insurrection, that looked strategic and tactical to you?
They did. Now, of course, I learned a lot more about this by seeing all the video. I mean, I wasn't sitting in a command center watching the video come in as these people stormed the Capitol in what in many ways did seem like a coordinated attack. So, you know, there's this dichotomy here where some of the president's defenders are saying that, well, look, if this was coordinated, if this was organized, it couldn't have been instigated by the president. It's not one or the other. Both can be true. There can be a lot of organization. These extremist groups, even potentially colleagues of mine who led them through the Capitol in the days leading up to the assault so that they would understand the layout and be prepared to do just that. That can be true, and also it can be true that the president of the United States was the one who called on them to actually do that. In the Marine Corps, we have plans for all sorts of things. We have plans to deal with North Korea if it invades South Korea. But it still takes the president of the United States to call the Marines to actually execute that plan. That's what happened on January 6th. The groundwork was laid by the president's allies and these extremist groups. And it was the president of the United States, the commander in chief of our country, who called on them to attack.
Does that make you angry?
It makes me furious.
You think
about all the amazing Americans I served with who raised their right hand and swore that oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and risked their lives to do the same. And yet we couldn't count on our commander in chief to not be a traitor.
No, go. I want to hear it.
I mean, it's just, I disagree. I mean, look, I served in Iraq under George W. Bush. I disagreed with the war. I disagreed with all kinds of decisions he made. I never imagined he would be a traitor to our country.
Those are strong words.
Well, that's what the president did. And we all have to come to terms with that if we don't want it to happen again.
I also want to talk about your colleagues. So in getting ready to talk to you today, I went back and listened to conversations that you and I had in January of 21 and January of 22. And one of the things that struck me was both your lack of reticence to call out your colleagues where it was necessary, and also an ongoing journey you were having with one of your Republican colleagues, where in 21, you thought you might be able to convince them to stand up and speak out. And by 22, you were saddened that that hadn't happened. I was specifically thinking of that. That's why I went back and listened to it this morning. I was specifically thinking of it yesterday when Florida Representative Stephanie Murray talked about a list of Republican members of Congress who were present for a December 21st meeting. Here it is.
According to White House visitor logs obtained by the committee, members of Congress present at the White House on December 21st included Congressman Brian Babin, Andy Biggs, Matt Gaetz, Louie Gohmert, Paul Gosar, Andy Harris, Jody Heiss, Jim Jordan, and Scott Perry. Then Congresswoman-elect Marjorie Taylor Greene was also there.
And that was, of course, part of a case being made that there was planning for January 6th and that that date was actually discussed at that December 21st meeting. Where are you personally with your Republican colleagues today? And what happened when you heard that list?
Well, in some ways, that list doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, these are the most extreme members of Congress today. Some of the most extreme members of Congress our country has ever seen. They're exactly the kind of people I would expect to be on that list, and certainly not the better Republicans that I was trying to convince to change their minds. But just the fact that I served with these colleagues, who all took that same oath, by the way, who took that same oath when they were sworn into Congress that the 17 and 18-year-old Marines I served with in Iraq took when they put their lives on the line for America. The fact that they would work with the president to plan an insurrection. I mean, it just doesn't, I can't add any words to how bad that is, Tiziana. It just doesn't get any worse in our country. I'm sorry, I'm kind of at a loss for words for what to say. It's so despicable. And frankly, it's embarrassing as a fellow member of Congress. So that leaders in our country would do that.
What do you want to have come out of all of this?
I want accountability because I want there to be change. I want to ensure that my daughters never have to worry about this happening to their democracy, to their America, when they grow up, when they're old enough to cast a vote. You know, they're 1 in 3 right now. They'll first be able to vote when they're 18. By that time, we better have fixed this. We better have ensured that they never have to worry about whether their vote will be counted, that they don't have to worry about a president of the United States trying to lead a violent insurrection against our own country. I mean, even during the Civil War, the Confederate troops never actually breached the Capitol. But Trump's guys did. They were there on January 6th. And you better bet they're ready to come back again.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is here with us from the 6th District. We've been talking about the hearings for the January 6th insurrection. Before we let you go, I want to talk for a minute about another vision you've had for the future, which is better mental health support in the United States. Especially, you've been transparent about your own experiences with mental health, and you wanted there to be an easier way to get support. It's coming this weekend, a new mental health emergency number, 3-digit 988, just like 911. It goes live on Saturday. Tell us what this means to you.
It means that millions of Americans all across the country can get help in a moment of crisis. If you or a loved one is having a mental health crisis, then you'll all know, just dial 988 from any phone, any network, no matter where you are, dial 988 and you'll be able to talk to someone. And you'll talk to someone who's a real pro at dealing with these crises. They're not going to call the police. If you're young, they're not going to call your parents. They're just going to help you in that moment of need. When I finally came to terms with the fact that I had post-traumatic stress from Iraq, I had no idea to get help for that. I didn't know the hotline if I was in a crisis. I was fortunate to be in school at the time. And so they had a health system that I could go and eventually talk to a therapist. And that's why I'm a member of Congress today, because I was able to take care of that issue. So many Americans just don't know where to turn for help. And this is going to change that. It's going to save thousands of lives every year.
Some of this is reliant on states being ready to catch those calls, respond to them, provide services. Do you think we're ready here in Massachusetts? And are you worried that there might be other states that aren't?
I've been working closely with Massachusetts, and I do think we're ready. I mean, look, this isn't going to be perfect on day one. I mean, when 911 was established, not every call got routed to the correct fire station on day one, but we're going to make this work. I am concerned that some of the other states are farther behind. Not all the states have taken this seriously. Not all the states are as serious as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts at addressing mental health. But the beauty of this number is it's going to highlight the problem to those states, and it's going to get them on board. The federal government has already stepped up. We've increased investment for this national priority 18-fold this year. So 18 times the investment of last year has gone into preparing for this. It's not going to be perfect on day one, but it's going to start saving lives the minute this goes live. And then we got to work on making it even better.
In our last 30 seconds or so, you've talked about how this might have helped you. Is there someone else you've loved or known that it would have made a difference for to have this number available?
Tiziana, I've lost 2 Marines from my second platoon since I came back. You know, in either case, neither was suicide. Maybe neither was in some ways directly attributable to this, but these were two great Americans, heroes, who, like all of us, struggled a bit when they came back. And I have to think that if it was a little easier to get help, if it was a little easier to talk to someone, I mean, one of them died just taking the prescription he was given by the VA after he asked to talk to someone and was sent home with meds instead. We can do better.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton of the 6th District, which includes Beverly, Reading, Peabody. Congressman, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us. Tune again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.